Hello and welcome to another episode of the World Athletics Podcast. I'm Ben Harlow, and in today's episode, we're chatting to distance running legend Steve Cram. We kind of rewind the clock and go back to his glory days of distance running when he battled with World Athletics President Sebastian Coe, swapping world records and world championship titles. And then we talk about his career off the track in commentary and broadcasting, where he commentated on some of the greatest events in world athletics history in the last few decades. He gives a really insightful interview and talks about the details of what it's like on and off the track. So I hope you guys enjoy it. So Steve, earlier we were talking about the no finish line race in Monaco, and I'd never really heard of a race like that. Can you just explain it again?
It's a great concept they have here, which is, and I think it's held in other cities as well. So there's a 1400 meter track that's been set out down near the stadium, and you, over 9 days, you can come down at any time and do as many laps as you want. It doesn't matter what your age or your ability or anything like that. And you kind of register and then you log in your laps. And I guess at the end of the 9 days, the idea is that they're trying to get as many people to cover as much distance as possible, both individually and collectively. And it's good fun. You see parents doing it with kids, and you can do it at your own level. It's interesting because your Paul and I have been working on something else called Families on Track, which we launched last year in the UK, which is very much a family orientated thing, which is not dissimilar, but it's much more over. You're going to cover 10K, and you have like a 1K lap, a 500 lap, a 250 meter lap, and you do it with the family as a team. So all of these initiatives are just about how do we engage people to start at whatever level they want to, one lap, come back tomorrow and do another one, or maybe 3 days time you come do three. When we're doing the Families on Track, that sort of thing is about, you know, you can, as a family, you know, dad can do a K, and you might have a 10-year-old does a 500, and you know, you might have a 5-year-old does a 250, and then you add it up to a 10K distance. And but you know, it's just always to try and engage people a little bit more with running in particular, which is great.
Okay, cool. And what would you say, it's quite a unique race, it's fair to say. What would you say is the weirdest race you've ever been to?
I've done very long races. I've done a 55 mile, which was the Comrades Marathon, which was an experience and a half. Actually, just recently, I did my first run bike run we organise events in the UK. We have the Kielder Marathon weekend, and on the Saturday we have a run bike run. And because it was our 10th anniversary, I thought I would take part. I'm not fit enough to do the marathon, so I thought I'd take part. Wow, that was hard. Yeah, that was tough. Here in Monaco, we did for charity. I've been here twice to do kind of it's like a running on boats, like a paddle boat thing out in the harbour.
Okay.
There are these weird kind of, they float, but you basically have a running, almost a cycling action, but it's almost more of a running action, which propels
it. Like a treadmill?
Yes.
Okay.
And it propels it not as fast as you would like. Again, we did that for charity and teams and laps in the bay here. That was weird.
Yeah, that is weird.
Yeah. So, yeah, I've done a few things.
Okay, cool. I think it's fair to say most people know you for a variety of reasons. I think, like, obviously you were an athlete. Mm-hmm. Then you are also a commentator, broadcaster, and you're also a coach. Mm-hmm. I think starting off in athletics, how did it come to be? How did you find the sport?
A long time ago, back in the 70s, more schools probably did a bit of athletics. And I was playing football more at the time. My uncle was actually a professional footballer. That's what I thought I wanted to do. But you go to senior school and they make you do cross country. Mm-hmm. And so I went out and did a couple of cross country things within the school, got picked for the school team to run against other schools, did okay. That was my first bit of running, but nothing kind of came of that so much until the following summer. Now you move into the track season, and I was running the 400 meters actually for my school. I didn't like running a long way back then.
Not 55 miles.
And the guy who was the coach from the local athletic club saw me, asked me to join. I didn't even know there was an athletic club, Jarrow and Hebden Athletic Club, which had been there since 1938, and I didn't even know. And he asked me to join the club, and that's how it started.
Rest is history. Were the rest of your family into athletics?
Yeah, my dad will tell you, he was a policeman, he'll tell you that he was a good runner in his day. My mum, less than, my mum was German. But on her side, the family, actually, I'm going to Germany in a couple of weeks to see the family for Christmas, but my uncle, one of my uncles was a semi-professional footballer, but he reckons he used to be a good runner as well. Mm-hmm. So there was various uncles and aunts who took your claimed it was their genetics, but yeah, I'm not sure anyone was. It must come from somewhere because there's something gets handed down, doesn't it?
I think what's really interesting about you is actually for the 1500 meters, you're actually the first ever world champion over 1500 meters. That year it was 1983, right?
Yeah.
Did you talk me through that year, just in the build up to that?
It's really challenging, I guess, to explain to people the environment that we were all in then. So it was the first world championships. We hadn't had one. The Olympic Games were our global. But the Olympics were in a fair bit of bother then. There'd been a boycott in 76. There was another boycott in 1980. I went the 80 Olympics as a 19-year-old, but the boycott and the Olympic movement was in a bit of trouble. So Track and Field, the International Athletics Federation, took the view that it needed to create its own global championships. Mm-hmm. And there were all sorts of ideas to begin with. And at one point, it was going to be kind of the top 50 ranked athletes. It didn't matter which country you're from. So not to make it different from the Olympics, it would be three per country.
That's interesting, actually.
Yeah, it wouldn't be three per country. Yeah. It would be just the top 50. Then that kind of got changed as there was lots of power struggles going on. So at one point, so there was another boycott in 84 as well. Mm-hmm. And at one point, they were threatening that the Olympics would be only for under 23 athletes. So to make the World Championships the real number one event.
Yeah.
So I think we ended up with a pretty similar format to the Olympics, top three from each country and went down that route. But it was a brilliant success. Mm-hmm. So you have to remember that was the first. Since the early 70s, for 10 years, it was the first proper global championships that everybody went to. It didn't matter which country, there were no boycotts. Everybody was there, and it was initially every 4 years as well. So it was a real privilege to win the first one. I was only 22.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say as well.
We had these two guys called Seb Coe and Steve Ovett, and everyone knows Seb now these days, but the two of them had set targets for me. They were sort of 4 or 5 years older than me, but I was very good at 17, went to the Commonwealth Games, 19 at the Olympics. And then through 81, 82, I was improving fast. In 82, I won the European Championships, I won the Commonwealth Games, started challenging those two. Mm-hmm. And so in 83, I stepped up another level. But then I had a couple of new rivals come in, a guy called Saïd Ouita from Morocco and Steve Scott of the US, who almost broke the world record just before the World Champs. So there was a whole host of, top level athletes whose times are still up there on the all-time list now. Mm-hmm. It was a great time to be a 1500 meter runner. Hard, mm-hmm. Really competitive, some of the best of all time all running at the same time. So it was, those world champs were tough to win, but it was something which I'm still very proud of that it was the first world champs. And there was Carl Lewis did really well in the sprints, and we had also people like Ed Moses around and others. There was a lot of the world's big names, mm-hmm. Daley Thompson and the decathlon, for whom those world champs were a seminal moment.
Yeah, you touched on it very briefly, but you were only 22 when you mm-hmm. actually became a world champion, which is really,
I graduated,
really young.
I graduated that summer as well.
Really?
Yeah.
How did you deal with the pressure of being such a young athlete, but then also becoming a world champion and everybody all of a sudden wanting a piece of you?
Yeah, the world was different then. And yes, the exposure was huge, mm-hmm. Much more so perhaps than now. We didn't have social media and things, but we did have worldwide global television. And even in the UK, the audiences would be 10 times almost what we get now. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're talking about, 20 million people watching the World Championships. A newspaper coverage was phenomenal. And mm-hmm. every newspaper had two or three athletic correspondents. The sport was one which internationally as well. I mean, to this day, I still travel to Europe and people of a certain age are going to know what we were all doing in the 80s and in Australia and the US, etc., because the sport was that big. But I think because I'd had, I was on the back page of the Daily Mirror when I was 17, mm-hmm. you know, I was still at school. I went to Commonwealth Games and things. So I'd grown up with exposure. Mm-hmm. So you find a way to deal with it. Everybody has their own way to deal with it. So I, excuse me, I really didn't know anything else. And actually I had Seb Coe and Steve Ovett to watch because they were getting, certainly when I was 18, 19, they were the biggest names in sport in Britain and some parts of the world.
Yeah.
And so being close to them, seeing how they both handled the media very differently. Mm-hmm. And you find your way to kind of work through with that. So yeah. I think it was more challenging actually for people around me, my mum and dad and family, friends, that sort of thing. I think I found my way to deal with it, but I think the impact it has on those around you can sometimes be greater and you don't realise it.
Yeah, it's quite strange, especially for Britain. It was the world record holder, the world champion and the Olympic champion, mm-hmm. all at the same time, three different guys.
Yeah.
I wasn't alive then when it happened, but was it like Beatlemania?
No, without being funny, I don't know. I wasn't around for Beatlemania. Maybe not quite at that level, but you know, yes, you know, you couldn't go in a shop. You couldn't, you know, without people knowing who you were. And it was nice because everybody was watching. Mm-hmm. So if I'd flown back from Oslo, and, you know, I was flying back to Newcastle Airport, whatever, everyone at the airport would be going, "Hey, saw you last night," you know, and it was so. It was very different to now where you know, not everyone will have seen you competing in the Diamond League the day before or even in championships. So and we, you know, we had, oh gosh, I'm going to sound like I come from just a different world. You know, there were three channels. Mm-hmm. So to give you an example, in 1985, I broke the world record in Nice. Mm-hmm. It was live on BBC One and ITV at the same time.
Okay.
Yeah. So the combined audience was nearly 30 million people.
Wow.
So the impact of what you did was huge. So inevitably, you know, the rest of your life is you're under observation to some extent. Thankfully, as I said, I didn't have to deal with social media and the rest of it. Then you could withdraw or engage with it kind of as much as you really wanted to. Mm-hmm. So you were able to take time to yourself and be as private as you wanted to, and you didn't have to do newspaper interviews if you didn't want to. You didn't have to have, you know, photographers following you around. It was hard for people to find out where you were, particularly if you don't tell them. So it was much easier to do that in those days.
How did you find having the three of you all being at the top of your game in Britain?
I would not have been as good had it not been for those two. Mm-hmm. You know, as I said, they set the bar very high for me. Imagine if I'd gone to the Olympic Games as a 19-year-old and I was the only British athlete in the final. Everyone would say, "Hey, well done, mate, you're doing really well." And you know, but I was ninth and nobody watched. They were watching Cornovet at the front. And so I knew that it was two things. One is they showed me that what was possible. And also they created a competitive environment just to get, you know, not obviously I helped, just to get on the British team, you had to be really, really good just mm-hmm. to get on the team. And then you knew what you were going to face when you got the championships. So, without them, you know, and there was other people in Britain at the time, Peter Elliott came through, an Olympic medalist, and Commonwealth champion. You know, we had a bunch of other lads who were running 3:33, 3:34, never made the team. Mm-hmm. They just couldn't get in the team.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah. So different times.
Well, fast forwarding, you went to 1984 Olympics, which mm-hmm. was a pretty pivotal moment for you guys, especially. Yeah. How was that?
It wasn't the best for me. I'd been injured. Mm-hmm. I had a great 82, 83, and then I got what became quite a famous injury. I stood on a Coca-Cola can while out running it was in November time, covered in leaves. I didn't see it. Really badly twisted, almost broke my ankle, and had like weeks which turned into months, and for a long time. And then I was coming back in the spring and picked up another bit of a problem, and for a long time I didn't think I was even going to go at the Olympics. And in those days we had pre-selection in Britain, mm-hmm. and I'd been pre-selected, Ovett had been pre-selected, Seb had to go to the trials. There's only one place left. Seb actually got beaten in the trials by Peter Elliott. so initially he wasn't selected, but he was the defending champion. Mm-hmm. I was injured and was quietly trying to get as fit as I could. So Seb had a troublesome approach, and it took a newspaper campaign by the Daily Mail and a public campaign to deselect Peter Elliott and pick Seb Coe. So that meant Seb, Mean, Ovette. I, even 3-4 weeks before, I wasn't sure I was going to be there. I ran one race, came last at Crystal Palace. Wasn't the best preparation. So in some ways, coming second to Seb in a great race, and Steve sadly didn't make it through the final. He was in the final, but stepped off in the last 400. I can't, you know, it's an Olympic silver medal that you know, I'll always cherish. I would have loved to have won the gold medal, but on that day I couldn't beat Seb. I wasn't fit enough to beat Seb. And who knows, even at my best, would I have beaten him, because Seb's a, you know, an all-time great, fabulous athlete. So, yeah, I was frustrated that I couldn't contest the race as well as I would have liked, but I was proud of what I managed to do on the day. I couldn't have run a scintilla of a second quicker than what I did.
Sorry to be annoying, and I know that you are mid-interview and hopefully really enjoying yourself, but I want to take a quick moment to talk about our social channels and how you can follow us and how you can keep up with all the athletics action outside of the podcast. So you can follow us at World Athletics on all platforms. We have a variety of content, from interviews to video highlights, live streams, and just all around good times. So go follow us, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, yeah, all of those. I think, well, for me personally, I always knew you as a commentator. I knew you were an athlete, obviously, but your voice, I've heard it attached to so many amazing athletics moments in history. How did you find commentating?
Oh, it wasn't easy at first, because I've had no training for it. I dropped in at the deep end. I was asked, would you fancy it? And I was awful at first. But the one good bit of advice I got was, treat it like the beginning of your running career. You know, you prep as much as you can, and you're going to make mistakes, mm-hmm. and accept your mistakes. Don't lose your confidence, and, you know, kind of, and be as natural as you can. You know, find your style, find your, and all that. Those were great bits of advice. And so I started at Eurosport. Not such big exposure, but it gave me the chance to work live television, which is stressful. Mm-hmm. And the other thing, I think, is the great thing about live sport is, particularly athletics, you never know what's going to happen. You can't write anything, you can't script anything. So obviously, having been an athlete, it just helps you in those moments where you've got a feel for it, you mm-hmm. know? So you... okay, I've raced everything from 400 up to a marathon. I did the triple jump once. I've never tried the pole vault. Actually, I have tried. I've tried that. But you're around. I was always around people. You know, mm-hmm. one of my best friends was Daley Thompson.
Yeah.
You know, he would sit and talk to me about the pole vault. Now, I'm not an expert on pole vault at all, but at least I understand a little bit of what I'm watching. Mm-hmm. Probably more than the people I'm commentating for at home. So. The challenge really was that multi-event approach, mm-hmm. trying to learn a little bit more about events and not say silly things.
Yeah.
But I think, as I said, what helped was it was my natural home. Mm-hmm. And so in those moments where there isn't a script, I still had something to say, and that's what commentary is about, I guess.
Yeah. What's been your favourite performance to commentate on?
Do I have to pick one?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay, I hark back to this just because she's a friend and the rest of it, but also, which is Paula's world record in the marathon.
Okay.
The reason why is that the marathon gives commentators, we've got 2 hours.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We've got a lot of leeway, you know. I think it's a close second between that and Usain Bolt, actually in Berlin in 2009. Mm-hmm. Not so much Beijing, as good as that was in 2008, but 2009. You know, Bolt was great to commentate. Mo Farah was great to commentate on. And Paula, you know, at her best, was great to commentate on. And those moments are, they stand out for you as both as a commentator and as a former athlete. Mm-hmm. I'm getting away with not giving you one, aren't I? And the one other I would throw in there, which was, commentators need dramatic races to really get ourselves to, you know, so Mo in London in the 5,000 in particular, you know, is he going to win? Is he not going to win? So Kelly Holmes, 2004, winning by the tiniest of margins, so much so that she didn't know when she crossed the line if she'd won. And I remember in commentary kind of doing the cardinal sin of forgetting I was commentating to people at home and almost trying to shout down to Kelly going, "You've won it, Kelly, you've won it," you know, kind of like hoping she might hear me, because she was, I knew she'd won, mm-hmm. but she didn't yet know. So there you go, there's a bunch. Pick which one.
Yeah. Okay, well...
Sadly, they're all, apart from you saying they're all British.
Okay, well, we can see that... Well, you saying he's a one of a kind, so I can get that. Okay, I guess final question. What would you say is your favourite race of all time? Not necessarily what you've commentated on, but just your favourite, or performance, doesn't have to be a race.
Do you know the one that had most impact on me as a young athlete, and I've talked about so many times... is the men's 5,000-metre final in the Montreal Olympic Games in 1976.
Okay.
And it was won by Lassie Vuren. It was his fourth gold medal in two Olympics. Okay. But it was one of the great pieces of... Because he had up against him some great runners, some moving up from the 1,500, people like Rod Dixon, Britain's Brendan Foster was there, and Ian Stewart, and then Hildebrand of Germany. We had Dick Quacks. And it was one of those races... People have got used to Mo Farah kind of going at the front with 600 to go and holding off all challenges. It was that sort of race. Mm-hmm. And Lassie Vuren was my first big hero in athletics. And that was kind of how I had to run 1500s as well, get to the front, get the pace going and go hurt everybody. And every time people looked like they were going to come past you, hold them off, and hopefully still win. So, and it is still, I always try and get athletes these days, are you looking for races to kind of going up? And I've replayed that one for athletes many times, or at least pointed them in that direction. So yes, it's a great race to watch. It was an Olympic final, a great Olympic champion, one of our, you know, one of my original athletic heroes.
That's some great tactics for some up and coming 1500 meter runners right there. Yep. Anyway, thanks a lot, Steve.
Cheers.
That is the end of this episode of the World Athletics Podcast. But if you want more athletics action, you can follow us on all social media platforms at World Athletics. Make sure you have rated and reviewed the podcast, and also subscribe, because on the next episode, we have an interview with 400 meter world champion Stephen Gardner.
Bahamian people, they love to celebrate, so they would find any reason to celebrate, you know? Yeah, just bringing a medal home to everybody at a time when we all needed it, because of the storm, and it brought joy to all of the islands, and everybody was so excited, and we celebrated, and when the storm came, it was a very hard time for me. I didn't get to train for 4 days because my family was couldn't hear a word from them. There was, like, some safe list on the internet, like, everybody who's safe from the storm, like, out of shelter or something. But my coach, he was helping me look through the list, and he was trying to call their cell phone to reach out to them and stuff like that.